me. This is the coordinator. I would like to inform participants today's conference is now being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, welcome everybody to the February Charm Telecon. We're lucky today to have a speaker, Dr. Larry Esposito, and he's the principal investigator on the Cassini Ultraviolet Imaging Spectrograph, UVIS, and he is in Boulder at the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado. So he's PI on UVIS, and I went looking around the web to find some introductory remarks about Larry, and you find interesting things about people, hopefully mostly good, and in this case it was. But one of the things that I found out about Larry is he was one of the people who was instrumental in discovering Saturn's F ring in the Pioneer days. That's something to his credit. And he's also been chosen recently as one of the finalists on the NASA New Frontiers program. Mission. There are three missions that have been selected, and I guess one will ultimately be chosen, and he's proposed a mission to Venus that would launch a probe, and it would go through the atmosphere and land up on the surface and do surface science at Venus. Larry's a prolific author and a contributor to science on topics of Saturn's rings and other things, too. He's worked done some work on the Enceladus plume as well. So he's got a talk today prepared for us. It's called Boom and Bust Cycles in Saturn's Rings, and I hope you've downloaded it from the CHARM site. I'll just remind Larry to let people know what page he's on and let the audience know that star 6 will mute their phone if they don't have a mute button. So with that, I'll welcome Larry Esposito.
So good afternoon, everyone. So I'm here at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and as is true, I did discover Saturn's F-ring, and I have been working for the last 20 years in charge of one of the dozen experiments on the Cassini orbiter, the Orbiter Ultraviolet Imaging Spectrograph, and I'll be talking to you about some of our new results from that Cassini investigation and how they're related to the history of Saturn's rings. So the title of my presentation is Boom and Bust Cycles in Saturn's Rings, and you should be looking at the cover slide right now. And I'm going to try to relate some of our observations, which were taken in the last year and are very strongly related to Cassini observations of Saturn's rings at the time of the equinox on Saturn, the moment when Saturn's rings were edge-on and to the sun. I'm going to say a little bit about that very spectacular moment in the history of the Cassini mission, the only chance we're going to get during this mission to look at the edge of the rings. And, of course, all of this happened, the analysis that I'm doing and the images in 2009, which I couldn't ignore the overall economic situation in the world, the boom and bust cycles in the economy, and in a flash, it came to me that potentially Saturn's rings have such a cycle where objects grow in the rings and then come apart. So this is about the history of Saturn's rings and particularly the history of the particles in Saturn's rings, those that grow to be moons that are big enough to be photographed by the Cassini cameras. So let's look at the first slide, features in the F-ring. So I've known the F-ring for a long time, more than 30 years since its discovery by Pioneer 11 in 1979. And when we were planning our investigations for Cassini with our experiment, and we had a number of international meetings, but one in Lisbon, the investigators, including me, decided that a good place to look for chunks of material in Saturn's rings would be Saturn's F-ring. Well, let me say just first, what are we really looking for? When we look from the Earth and see Saturn in a telescope, of course we can see the spectacular rings. And early on, astronomers thought they might possibly be solid, you know, big sheets, rings of metal, maybe steel or iron. that were circling Saturn, but it's been shown both that that's physically unstable and also by measuring the light reflected from Saturn's rings, that instead Saturn's rings are made up of billions and billions of little particles, each orbiting Saturn, each on its own individual orbit, so that the particles in Saturn's rings are like a very flat cloud around the planet, formed of trillions of small objects, and those objects are mostly made of water ice. The same sort of thing you keep in your refrigerator, in your freezer, to cool your mixed drinks. So these trillions of objects, the particles in Saturn's rings, are circling the planet, and we know from the measurements that Voyager made 25 years ago and also from Cassini measurements that the rings are pieces of ice ranging in size from tiny little ice grains the size of a hair up to individual objects that are small moons embedded in Saturn's rings. And we call these moonlets for a reason, a diminutive, to characterize them from the larger moons, 63 of which are circling Saturn at the present time. So in addition to the moons that circle Saturn, there are moons that are embedded in the ring system. And there are smaller objects, maybe we call them moonlets, but we could also call them large ring particles. The biggest ring particles are perhaps kilometers across. The challenge is it's very hard to see such objects. The objects are just at the resolution of the Cassini cameras, and up until just about a year ago, no clear objects had been seen anywhere in the main rings. On the other hand, getting back to Saturn's F ring, we were interested with our experiment to also look for objects in the rings, and we wanted to look in a place where they would be visible to us. So at this meeting in Lisbon back in 2002, the team got together, and we decided to concentrate on Saturn's F ring. And the reason is, there actually are two reasons. As we get further from the planet, it's easier for things to stick together. There's a limit within which the forces of gravity from the planet would tear a moon apart. And so it's better to look outside that particular limit, and Saturn's F ring is. The second thing was more practical. Because Saturn's F ring is a very thin ring, it would be easiest to see objects in there. They wouldn't be corrupted by lots of little ring particles that got in the way there. So this is, I explain to people, this is sort of like the drunk who looks for his keys near the lamppost, because, of course, the light is better there. And the same way, it's easier for us to see objects in Saturn's F ring because the background ring is dimmer and thinner. So, as I said, back in 2002, we decided to emphasize looking for objects that might be moonlets, small objects in the rings, that either could be on their way growing bigger to become moons or potentially to be shattered, to be broken up into ring particles. Now, I'm going to stop for just a second. Does anybody have a question about that?
Well, let's see, shattered by collisions rather than shearing?
Rather than what? I'm sorry?
Rather than tidal shearing.
Right. So, as you know, we humans are inside the Roche limit, inside the shearing limit for the Earth, and we're not torn apart by tidal forces. So for something like a moon to be torn apart, it has to be hit by another moon, another moonlet, or potentially a meteorite. So those things could shatter ring particles. And so we're interested in the balance between particles sticking together and particles shattering. I'll have a little more to say about that later. Other questions?
I have one.
Yes, go ahead.
Did you say 63 moons?
Yes, that's what I said.
Cool. All right. When did you decide that?
So I just read it on the webpage. You can go look to the web page. We're discovering them all the time on Cassini, so if I haven't read the page recently enough, it might be a few more.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. So for practical and physical reasons, we decided to look at the F-ring, and now I have to explain what I mean by look, because although we have an imaging spectrometer, the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, UVIS, it is possible to take images. Our resolution is even worse than the cameras, maybe 100 times worse. So it would be unlikely for us to make a picture of anything that was too small for the cameras to see. And luckily, we've got a different sort of design on our instrument that allows us to look for very tiny structures in Saturn's rings, and that's the technique of watching stars that pass behind the rings, what's called a stellar occultation. The word occultation comes from the same root as occult, so that's when the star darkens, when, as seen from Cassini, it passes behind Saturn's rings. And, of course, because the rings are not uniform, the star actually flickers, gets less and more blocked by the ring particles, and this allows us to measure structures in the rings. And the key part of that is that the resolution that we have to do that, the smallest structures we can see are about 10 meters across, which is either 100 or 1,000 times smaller than what can be seen by the cameras, except under special conditions, which I'm going to talk about in just a second. So by watching stars pass behind the rings, we watch the flickering of the stars, and that tells us the nature of the rings, including the possibility that there are small objects, moonlets, and other aggregations of material inside the ring. And so in 2002 at Lisbon, we planned to watch as many stars as we could, at least one, and we're hoping maybe 10 or more stars pass behind Saturn's F-ring, and particularly to look for any indication of larger objects in the rings. So now we're back to my slide. In 2008, we identified 13 statistically significant features, that is, times when the star had dimmed that were very unlikely to be caused by chance, and we interpreted these features in the rings as actually temporary clumps of ring material and a possible moonlet, which we nicknamed Mittens. And the reason we picked Mittens, we've been using cat names for all these features as their nicknames, is because we think they're transient. They come and go. The particles stick together and then they come apart. And I mentioned earlier there's a balance between formation of moons and shattering of moons. So even with particles sticking together at the same time that we're making moons or moonlets in the ring system, we're also breaking them apart. So we started naming these temporary features after cats. And so there was Mittens and Sylvester and Pie Wacket and Butterball, Fluffy, etc. And my student Bonnie Meinke has just now written a paper where we catalog 39 features from the first 103 stellar occultations by Saturn's F-ring. So we were lucky in the mission, the Cassini mission, and also in the Cassini extended mission, that we got to see more stars than we originally hoped, more than 100 stars. And for every one of these features, which we interpret as a clump of material, potentially a moonlet, in Saturn's F-ring, we have a location, a width, a maximum optical depth, and also a nickname, cat's name. So if you go to the next slide, which is called F-Search, F-Ring Search Method, you can see some of our data. And I know this is a disappointment to people that we don't have a picture here. We have been able to turn some of our data into pictures, but basically what we see is starlight, which is a wiggly line. So we watch the number of stars. If you look at this diagram, on the right-hand side you see a figure. The vertical axis is the number of counts, that is how many photons we count from the star. And on the bottom axis is distance from the center of the F-ring, from minus 15 kilometers to plus 15 kilometers. And you can see two squiggly lines there. The more squiggly one is from UVIS, and the less squiggly one is from VIMS. We are both watching the same star, that is, we thought we were, Alpha Sco. But it turns out the visual infrared mapping spectrometer, VIMS, is only sensitive in the infrared and we're only sensitive in the UV. So it's very seldom that we are able to see the same star. And in this case, it turned out we weren't actually able to see the same star. Alpha Sco turns out to be a double star. One star is bright in the UV, and the other star is bright in the infrared. And so each of those instruments watched a separate star pass behind the rings. And you can see in the red arrow there, there's a place where both spectrometers measured the starlight dimming from two different stars at the same location. And that assures us that there was something real in the ring, a clump of material that blocked that starlight. And we named it Piwacket, or nicknamed it Piwacket. Now, that's a familiar name. Does anybody know that name? So it's the name of Kim Novak's familiar in Bell, Book, and Candle. It's a movie about a witch at Wellesley College. But in any case, her cat was named Piwacket, her familiar, and that's why it's a familiar name. Next slide here. And we're looking now at Alpha Vir, which is the star Spica, and zoomed in to the core of that. Once again, the squiggly line is the light from the star, and there's a broad feature there where the star gets dimmer. That's Saturn's F ring. And then there are two little features, one butterball and one nicknamed Fluffy there. So these are what we're looking at in our data. They're fluctuations in the starlight that are almost certainly caused by structures in the rings, which we interpret as clumps of material. Let's go to the next slide. So what can we measure? This one is entitled Opacity. What can we measure about each of those clumps? And here I've got some real cats in front of their feeding bowls. And you can imagine the feeding bowls are like the stars. So for the feeding bowl on the left, there's no cat, and the opacity is zero. For the cat on the right, it's relatively thin. You can see a lot of the bowl. The opacity is small. And then the cats get successively fatter, with the fattest cat hiding his bowl. In the same way, the densest clumps in the rings are the most opaque, and they hide the star. So we can look at the opacity of these various clumps as a function of where they are in Saturn's F ring. So let's go to the next slide. So these objects, which we've nicknamed kittens, amazingly enough, show a dependence on where they are relative to the moon Prometheus. Now, you probably know that Saturn's F ring is kept in place by a moon on either side. They're called the shepherding moons, and Prometheus is the moon on the inner side of Saturn's F ring, and it passes by any one particle in Saturn's F ring every 68 days. So, surprisingly enough to us, the opacity increased following the Prometheus passage, and in fact, if we tried to fit a straight line to that, we got a correlation coefficient of a half, which is a very significant correlation, which means, once again, this is not something very likely to occur by chance. So we're seeing a real phenomenon where in Saturn's F ring, after Prometheus passes by, the material tends to clump up and the clumps get thicker. Now, I have to say, we never would have expected this. And why did we search in this way? I was at a Cassini meeting last summer in London, and Carl Murray, who's on the camera team, had made some movies of Saturn's F ring at this particular time of equinox, that is, when the sun was very low. And as I said earlier, the cameras typically don't have the resolution. They're unable to see anything as small as we can see in the occultations. But at this time of equinox, the sun is very low in the sky, and any object in the ring casts a long shadow, maybe 60 to 100 times longer than the object itself. So it's just like sunset on the Earth. And so at sunset, a telephone pole would cast a shadow which was much longer than it. And if you were flying over an airplane, even if you couldn't see the pole, you would see the shadow. And so in the same way, in Saturn's F ring, and I'm going to say a little bit later, also in Saturn's B ring, the Cassini cameras saw these long shadows, which indicated objects in Saturn's rings, completely unexpected, or at least I didn't expect them. And as soon as we saw those data in London, I came back here to Boulder, and we started looking through our data to see if the objects we were seeing had any relationship to Prometheus. In the movies that Carl Murray had made, these clumps, these objects that cast long shadows, appeared just after Prometheus had passed by the F-ring. So we came back, and we were surprised, happily surprised, to see that, go to the next slide here, where there's a picture of Saturn's F-ring. Saturn would be up at the top of your screen. Prometheus is shown by a big black dot, and the motion of Prometheus is counterclockwise in this figure. So when it passes by the F-ring, it gets ahead. It's going a little bit faster than the particles in the F-ring due to Kepler's laws, because it's closer to Saturn, just like Mercury and Venus go around the Sun faster than the Earth. And after it passes by the F-ring, we're looking in the quadrants leading and trailing of the spot where the ring was closest to the Moon. And it's at these various longitudes that we have measurements from our 100 stellar occultations. So I'm going to stop here just for a second. Anybody have a question or a comment? So let's go.
I have one.
See? Yes, go ahead.
From looking at the graphs of Butterball and Luffy, can you estimate the size of those moons?
Oh, yes. In fact, you can probably see by looking at the tick marks down on the bottom, the radial distance from Saturn, that they're about 100 meters across.
100 meters? Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah, you can. Each of those tick marks is 100 meters distant. So such objects would be invisible to the cameras. The camera is not capable of seeing anything so small unless it's this special geometric condition where they cast long shadows.
So they're bigger than moonlets.
So these, Butterball and Fluffy are, they're probably clumps and not moonlets. They're probably, because we can still see light coming through them, the bottoms of those curves don't go all the way to the bottom line on the graph.
Okay.
So they're probably not completely opaque. Their opacity is small enough that light can get through them. So they're probably clumps of material, which we're naming after cats, and they're the same size as these possible moonlets. But
okay,
they're too small to be seen by the cameras.
Because they're farther out, do you expect them to stay, or do you expect them to break apart?
I expect them to break apart.
Okay.
They're transient, and that's why we're giving them cat names, like the nine lives of the cat.
Okay.
That's why we gave them the cat names, because we think they're transient.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Other questions? So let's go to the next slide, which is the one that says optical depth and means by quadrant, all features. So there are 39 points on here. And just at the point zero is just 0 degrees on the bottom scale is where the ring particle is just opposite Prometheus. So if you go back to the previous slide, that would be where that vertical line is. That's at 0 degrees. So next slide, again, optical depth slide. And we have also averaged the opacity in each of these quadrants, in each 90 degrees after Prometheus. And what you see is that the opacity, the average opacity of these features, these transient clumps, increases, and then it decreases. So it goes up, and then it comes back down with a maximum of maybe 90 to 180 degrees after closest flyby. Let's go to the next slide. So that's about the F-ring. I also mentioned Saturn's B-ring. That's the brightest ring you can see from the Earth, the biggest one. And the edge of the B-ring is at a place in the rings called the Cassini Division, which you can also see from the ground in a good telescope. That separates Saturn's A and B rings. And so from the ground, if you see two rings, the outer ring is the A ring, the inner ring is the B ring, and in between them is a little dark lane, which is called the Cassini Division, which originally people might have thought was empty, but it turns out to be filled with material, but that's probably another talk that I won't give here. Why is there this separation between ring A and ring B? I'm going to pause for an answer from the audience. Well, not hearing an answer, why does Saturn have two rings you can see from the Earth? The answer that's been given for the past 30 or 40 years, probably true, is that a particle moving at the very edge of the B ring, that is just at the Cassini division, just at the point that separates the two bright rings you can see from the ground, it orbits Saturn twice as fast as Saturn's moon, Mimas. And therefore, it's what we would say resonating with Mimas. It goes around twice every time Mimas goes around once. And the technical term for that is the 2-to-1 resonance. And this 2-to-1 resonance is a forcing on the particles in the rings, the same as if you went to the swing set with your children or your niece, and you push them at exactly the natural frequency of the swing. Everybody knows that you can pump up the swing to a high amplitude if you push at exactly the right time. If you push at the wrong time, you just make your daughter angry. So that does no good. But if you push in time with the natural swing of the pendulum, with its natural frequency, then you can get a high amplitude. And so in the same way, the particles that are orbiting Saturn in Saturn's rings are pulled by the gravity of Mimas. And this little pull at the location of the outer edge of the B-ring is resonating. That is, the pull is exactly in time with the particle's orbital motion. So that's like pumping up on the swing. And so those particles get pumped up, and their orbits get modified, and a couple other things that happen, which I won't mention, but that is sufficient to truncate the ring at that location, and therefore that explanation of resonance, the 2-to-1 resonance of the ring particle's motion with the orbital period of Mimas, is the explanation of why Saturn has two rings. The other rings are harder to explain, not possible even in this hour here. So because of that theory, you'd expect a certain shape to the edge of the ring, which is an elliptical shape, which could be fit by a cosine function with mode m equals 2, or that is to say, two peaks and two troughs around the ring. So from the theory that explains why Saturn has two rings, there's a prediction for the shape of the ring edge, and it says it should be an elliptical pattern with two peaks and two troughs. Next slide. Well, we're measuring not only the shape of the edge, but also the opacity, the optical depth at the edge. And this is, of course, from our 100 or so stellar occultations that have been taken over time. So we're looking at the slide now that says optical depth over time. And here we have, over the Cassini mission, the measured optical depth of the edge of Saturn's B ring as a function of time. And you can see right away that it's not constant, that over the 4 years of the mission, the opacity at the edge of Saturn's biggest ring has been increasing. We don't have an explanation for this yet, but I'll give you a speculation at the end. And furthermore, sometimes we don't see this pattern, the M equals 2 pattern. Go to the next slide. It says no M equals 2 pattern. So the red line is what the theory predicts. The black diamonds are what we see. They don't fit. Usually people don't give a charm telecon if the data aren't fit by the model, but I'm just showing you the truth here. And on top of that, let's go to the next slide. I'm going to talk about sub-kilometer structure that's seen in the rings as well. So I was saying already that our experiment, the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, UVIS, can see objects that are 100 times smaller than those that can be seen in the images. But we can also see features that are even tinier if we don't try to make a picture of them. And the way that we do this is we measure through mathematical analysis the power that's in the rings. And we sort that into powers of various length scales. So this is sort of like watching an oscilloscope. I don't know if you've seen this on the crime series, but there's somebody's voice is recorded, and then the police officers break down that voice into its natural tones. And from those tones, they can identify the speaker. At least that's how it works on the movies. In the same way, we can break down all that structure that's in the rings, all the blinking on and off and all the flickering of light, into structures of various lengths, not tones in the sense of sounds, but waves that have a certain wavelength. And therefore, we can see if the rings are very quiescent. In that case, there's no power there. Or if the rings are agitated, then we detect power in this mathematical analysis, like using an oscilloscope on some criminal's voice. So we use a similar approach through time series analysis of our data to look for significant lengths, the lengths where there's significant power in the data. And once again, this is something I decided to do after seeing those pictures in London of the shadows cast by objects in the rings, because I said those ought to be visible to us in the occultations too. And amazingly enough, when we did this, we found that the rings were more agitated, but at 90 and 270 degrees after Mimas had passed them by. So remember I showed you Prometheus, the kitten features were optically thicker after Prometheus passed by, and we found using a different sort of analysis with the B-ring edge that the structure in the rings was also enhanced 90 and 270 degrees after Mimas had flown by. And this, as I said, was also not coincidental because there were also images that had been taken of the B-ring edge during the equinox period that showed objects right at the edge casting long shadows. So let's go to the next slide. So this is the one entitled Structure Increasing Near B-Ring Edge. And the structure, the amount of structure is color-coded. You can see that in the bar at the bottom. And the significance of the features we're seeing, that is how unlikely they are to be caused by chance, is given by the brighter colors. And what we've got here, we've got four different panels for four different year-long periods since the start of the Cassini mission. And on the vertical scale of each, we have the characteristic wavelength of the feature we're seeing, how big it is. And on the horizontal scale, we have the distance from the B-ring edge as we find it in our data, not exactly where it was predicted to be, of course. And you can see two things here. You can see that there's structure, red and yellow, near the edge of the rings, near where zero is. So that means the rings are agitated near the B-ring edge, which would be something that might be consistent with seeing objects that cast shadows there. And you can also see, as we said before, that the amount of structure in the ring seems to be increasing from the start of the mission through 4 years later. Next slide. This is the one here that where we've taken the same sort of information and bend it up by 30-degree bends. And you can see in the third bin down on both the left and the right-hand side that there's more yellow and red in the data. That is, there's more structure that we see in Saturn's rings. And this is very unexpected for us, maybe even more unexpected than seeing particles at the edge of the B-ring. At the same location, we see structure that comes and goes over an orbital period. And the particles in that part of the ring orbit Saturn in just 10 hours. I'm going to stop here again. A question, a comment? So seeing none, let's go to the next slide, which says density wave sub-kilometer structure, strength versus resonance torque. So the resonance that creates the edge of the B-ring that separates Saturn's A and B rings is the strongest resonance in the rings, but there are other resonances where moons go around at or near a natural frequency of the rings. And you can see them listed here. There's the Mimas 2-1, which is the B-ring edge on the far right. There's the Janus 6-5. That's where Janus goes around five times every time a ring particle at a particular location, particular distance from Saturn, goes around six times, 5-4, 4-3, and the Mimas 5-3. And on the horizontal scale, from pure physics, we've calculated how strong that resonance is. How much does it push the particles around, equivalent to how hard you push your niece on the swing set. And on the left, we have the wavelet probability or significance of our features, and there seems to be a pretty good correlation, nothing that we would have predicted, which seems to say the stronger the resonance is, the harder the moon is pushing on the rings, the more structure we see in the rings. So this put together a story for me, which I'm going to summarize in the next slide, called Observational Findings. So inspired by pictures of the rings taken at this geometrical situation that occurs every 15 years on Saturn, where the sun is at a very low altitude and the ring particles, if there are any moonlets, cast long shadows, that we looked at our data to see if there's anything that's correlated with where the moons are and the forcing, the pushing around that the moon's gravity causes on the ring particles. And we found the following things, which are these five bullets. Those F-ring kittens are more opaque, trailing Prometheus. The B-ring edge is more opaque, leading Mimas. And, of course, once again, the ring particles are going around faster than Mimas, so after they pass closest to Mimas, they would be leading. And sub-kilometer structure, that is structure at scales smaller than a kilometer, which was seen by our analysis at the strongest density waves and at the B-ring edge, is correlated with the torque, that is the strength of the density waves, and the longitude at the B-ring edge. And the variance in the location of the B-ring edge and the strength of the structure is increasing since 2004. And I've said here that the largest of the structures we see, a kilometer or two across, could be visible to the imaging system. I was having a little political challenge with the imaging system. They were wanting to interpret their data before any of the other members of the Cassini project talked about them. So even though I had seen those pictures, the people in my audience, and maybe you too, last summer, had not seen those particular pictures. So I said the largest structures that we were seeing could be visible to the imaging system, the cameras on Cassini. As it turns out, they are. Or they do see things that are larger, and it's potentially the same phenomenon we're seeing in the occultation data. So I'm going to stop for a second here about the observational findings. Anybody have a question or a comment?
Yes, it's something I just don't think I quite understand. How can you tell the difference on Mimas that it's leading if it seems that the 90 and the 270, it's the strongest?
Yes.
How do you see the difference between leading and following?
Let's go right back here, and you can see the relative longitude of 270, which is leading Mimas, that it's stronger than at 90. So those are the third panel down on the left and the right-hand sides.
Okay, yeah, I see that.
So, yes. And let's go back here again to the observational findings. And that's not what you would expect from the linear theory that people have used to explain the occurrence of the B-ring edge. So we're seeing something non-linear there. That is something that is might be caused by the fact that Mimas is closer to the rings at one part of that ellipse than at the other. So the features in the rings go around twice as fast as Mimas. They rotate. The individual particles in the rings are going around twice as fast, but the structure that we see is stronger. That's most recently been close to Mimas. Now Mimas is only two and a little bit Saturnian radii from the center of Saturn. So that means it's about 2.5 times further away from Saturn than the rings are. And so it could potentially be the fact that Mimas is a little bit closer, that those measurements are stronger at one longitude, not at the other. Other questions, comments? Okay. So now, next picture. This is one of those famous images where you can see some of these structures. So everybody look with me. You see a big dark triangle in this picture. Everybody see that? That's the shadow of Mimas on the rings. So Mimas is 100,000 kilometers away, but because of the low angle of the sun, its shadow is cast on the rings. And if you look at the B-ring edge, which is this bright line in the middle, you can see there are little triangular shadows right behind that bright edge. If anybody can't see that, please say and I'll direct you more carefully. You see that? You see all those little shadows, all those little triangles? And if you look at the bottom, the base of those triangles, there's a bright spot in the picture for each of those. So this was during equinox, and what's happened is the sun is so low that the shadows are much longer than the objects, maybe 10 or 20 times longer. But the shadows are easily resolved, and each one of those little shadows is a little structure in the rings, maybe a moonlet or maybe something more transient. And we think what we're seeing when we watch stars go behind here at even higher resolution is that unresolved structure in the rings in our wavelet analysis, and also occasionally maybe individual effects of one of these clumps. I'm ready to go to the next slide. This is a slide now, Saturn's off to the left. This is a different part of the ring. This is Saturn's A ring. And you can see there's a dark vertical lane. That's the Encke gap of Saturn in Saturn's rings. And you can see, once again, these little streaks here left of that dark lane. Each one of those is a little clump in the rings and potentially could aggregate together to make a moonlet in the ring. But unfortunately, they're probably mostly transient. They probably come and go, just like the structure that we see around the edge of the B-ring that we think is forced by Mimas. And this would be forced by a little moon called Pan that's embedded in the gap here, but you can't see in this particular image. Questions about those images?
Yeah. Does this mean that it's on the edge of the ring that the structures are larger than more interior?
So why does the ring have edges? The ring has edges because that's where the moons are forcing the ring particles. And so where the rings are forcing, ring particles are being forced by moons is where they stick together. I'm going to say that a little bit more later on. So the edges are only there because of the moonlet gravity. The moon's gravity, which creates small moonlets there, which could even create more structure in the rings. So, yes, the reason why we see these on edges is because that's where the moon's gravity is pushing around the ring particles and, in fact, pushing them together so that they stick. Is that answering your question?
Yes. So that implies that on the inside it's much smaller particles.
So I'm going to be a little bit careful here. So these things I'm calling clumps and not particles. They're made up of particles. So the ring particles are the same size, but they stick together, they aggregate. So those are things, they're made up of ring particles too, those little diagonal things there. Particles probably having the same size distribution as the particles in the grayer areas to the left. But they're temporarily aggregated into clumps of ring particles. You can see in the middle of this image that there's a density wave there. You can see a wave passing through the rings. And we would say at the strongest part of that density wave, which is the brightest lane furthest to the left, that there might also be clumping occurring there. You can't see it in the images, but in our data that I showed a graph a couple slides back, you can show in the mathematical analysis for structure that there are more structures at those locations. Other questions?
Larry, could I ask you a question on slide 16, please?
Which one is that?
I'm sorry, slide 17, the one with the triangles.
So slide 17, I have one with diamonds. What's the caption? I don't have the numbers here on my presentation.
Well, it's the first one of the rings you showed us with the shadow of the moon.
Right, it's a Cassini image, right.
In the back wave right up the center, there's a small dot on the left-hand side. I'm wondering if that's one of the moons.
So let's see. So you're talking about up in the B ring, inside the edge, there's a little dot.
Yeah.
I don't know what that dot is. But potentially it could be a small object that's creating a wake in the rings. You see there's sort of a dash next to it if you're looking at the same one?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that could be, but unfortunately these aren't my data, so I can't really interpret those. You'd have to ask somebody on the imaging team that question.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going
another question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, you mentioned that the moonlets that are in the gaps tend to create the discrete edge on those gaps through gravity. Why wouldn't you expect them to drag the particles outward since the gravity would be pulling on them, not pushing on them?
You're remembering that gravity is an attractional force.
Yes.
Right. So here's the answer. I'm going to take just a minute to try to answer this. Suppose you're an astronaut on the space shuttle and you throw your orange peels over the side. What happens? Basically nothing.
They would
orbit
in one direction and they would go in another direction.
They just orbit with you.
Oh, yeah, they would orbit with me.
Right, because you're both in orbit around the Earth.
Right.
And here's another question. Suppose you put your brakes on the space shuttle. Do you go faster or you go slower?
Inside.
No, you're in the space shuttle.
Yes.
You put on the brakes. You turn the jets in the direction you're flying and fire the engines.
I would start spiraling down toward the Earth. I don't.
Right, exactly. And then do you go faster or slower?
I would slow down. I think. Right.
No. Kepler's laws say Mercury goes around faster than Venus.
Oh, that's right.
Venus.
Yeah, as I get closer to the Earth, I would speed up.
Right.
Right.
So this is the answer to your question. If you pull on particles, you move them to a higher orbit where they go slower.
Yeah.
And therefore they move away from you.
That is not intuitive, but
right, I'm sorry, it's counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Yeah, read my book on this.
Okay.
But in any case, that's why in the gravitational field of Saturn, or like the space shuttle in the gravitational field of the Earth, it's the gravity of the Earth that matters and not the gravity of the space station or the orange peels.
Okay, I got you. That makes
sense. So in that field, following Kepler's laws, gravity although it's attractive, it pushes particles away. This is how shepherding moons can keep a ring in between them, because they repel the particles due to their gravity in the field of Saturn. think about that. If you still have a question at the end, I'll try to address that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to go to possible explanations. This is what everybody has been waiting for here. So here's a possible explanation. So I'm saying that this interesting behavior, which I call chaotic here, arises from the resonant forcing on ring particles that causes them to jam together like traffic jams seen in the computer simulation. I'm going to show you one of these computer simulations, but in a perfect ring, all the particles are like the cars on the LA freeway on Sunday. No car ever runs into another car. They all zoom around in their own particular orbit, staying in their own lanes. But the real rings are not such an ideal society. Because the moons are pulling on them, the particles get eccentric velocities. They move outside their purely circular orbit. This is like crossing your lanes on the freeway. And they crowd together at the points where their streamlines cross. And that's where they're exactly near the moon or at some other resonant location. And so unlike a perfect society like the LA freeways, which I was driving on Sunday and didn't have any trouble, Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock, there's a problem. The cars merge together and they can't get past each other. They clump up. It's a traffic jam. The same sort of thing happens in rings. The gravitational forcing from the moon causes the ideal motions of the ring particles to merge, to cross, and because they're real particles, like real Volvos and real BMWs and real Mercedes-Benz, they can't cross each other, and they clump up and they slow down. We get a traffic jam in the rings, just like on the freeways. And this was studied by Mark Lewis and Glenn Stewart at the University of Colorado, published in 2005. So the moons are really disturbing the system. They're making it a bad day on the freeway. And on top of that, the particles in the rings have their own little gravity, which causes them to sort of clump together, at least temporarily. And those clumps have even more gravity, which disrupts the rings around them. So it's really like, you know, the motion of the moons at these resonant locations is putting little pushes and pulls on the particles in the rings, which is like pushing and pulling on the cars on a freeway, and the same thing happens. We get a traffic jam. And that traffic jam naturally grows, just like on the freeway. So we can see then that if we're looking for, and we think the Cassini measurements show, temporary clumps, that would be natural to expect them in the regions where the moons are forcing the rings. Let's go to the next slide. So there's a picture from Lewis and Stewart of the F ring, and you can see that in the center here, the ring particles are clumping together. That is, on the left, they look sort of uniform, but in the center, they're wiggling, and they've made some strands. So now we want to go back just a couple slides to the B ring again, the one with the Mimas shadow on it. Look at that bright line in the middle. If you look at it on the left, you see that it's also broken into a couple of strands that merge together back to the computer simulations. So we contend that that structure that's seen right there, where we also see lots of these little temporary aggregations, is just like what is predicted from numerical models that calculate the traffic jams in Saturn's rings. So this was quite an experience for us, that models, theoretical models that we had run here before seeing any pictures of Saturn's rings at equinox, look a lot like what we're seeing. And so we think that the B ring edge, like the F ring, is strongly perturbed by nearby moons, Mimas for the B ring edge and Prometheus for the F ring, and a similar phenomenon is occurring. Now I have to warn the listener to beware that on the imaging team, they've published two separate papers. One paper about the F ring by Burl et al. Out of England, and one paper about the B-ring edge published by Spitali and Porco in Boulder, Colorado. And they don't conclude that anything similar is happening. So from looking at our data from the UV imaging spectrograph, I'm concluding that the two papers that written by the imaging team are actually related, whereas their authors don't conclude that. So right now, beware that this is somewhat speculative, and the interpretations of the various authors on the camera team are different as opposed to my clumping these two phenomena together. Next slide is my summary. It says, Cassini occultations of strongly perturbed locations show accretion and then disaggregation on a scale of hours and weeks. So not only do we see things come together, we see things come apart. Moons could trigger accretion by streamline crowding. That's that traffic jam phenomenon, which enhances collision, leading to accretion, which the gravity increases the random velocity, leading to more collisions and more accretion. So what we're saying is when you perturb the system with a moon, you know, if you create a traffic jam, it tends to get bigger rather than smaller. On the other hand, disaggregation is also seen, and that could follow from disruptive collisions, that is, two of these clumps running into each other and smashing them apart, or by tidal shedding, the tidal forces sort of stretch out these unconsolidated objects and pull the little pieces off on the edge. So this is the point where I'm getting back to the history of Saturn's rings. There's a good question that's out in the field right now, are Saturn's rings young or are Saturn's rings old? And the young people say, the people who say young, are arguing that all sorts of features in Saturn's rings come and go very quickly, much less than the age of the solar system. And the people who say old, including an older person like myself, say, well, wait a minute, you're confused here. Just because everything is young doesn't mean that the rings have just arrived. I was at a meeting in Beijing, and they're using the old Ming tombs marble to make new structures in downtown. So, and you walk on the street, and you don't see a Chinese person who's older than 100. That doesn't mean that Beijing is less than a century old. It just means there's some sort of renewal process. So there are some people that say Saturn's rings look young and they're not very old geologically, maybe younger than dinosaurs. Others that say they could be as old as the solar system if they had a recycling process. And here in Boulder, we're very big on recycling. So recycling the rings could make them older than we think. The features just are continually renewed. And to do recycling, that means you have to have aggregation in the rings. You have to take individual particles and make them back into moonlets or moons. So I'm one of those fans of the old rings, and naturally I'm interpreting these data as showing ongoing accretion, aggregation in the rings, which would be recycling. Well, philosophically, not only as a native of Boulder, Colorado, but philosophically as a person who thinks the rings are old, ready to interpret these information as showing ring accretion, ring aggregation, and ring recycling. Let's go to the next slide. My conclusions. So Saturn's rings appear young, but we may confuse age with the most recent renewal. That was just what I was saying about Beijing. And now we get the economy analogy. This was at the top of my mind when people were out of work here in Colorado and around the world. Like the global economy, the rings may not have a stable equilibrium. There's some sort of balance between sticking together and coming apart. But instead, that might be boom and bust triggered by stochastic events. That is, the moon forces things, but then a particular object runs into another one and sticks. That's a random event. And recycling of ring material allows the rings to be as old as the solar system, just as I said. Now, where do predators and prey come into this? Well, you know, if you in the economy, there are people in the U.S. and around the world who were trying to boost the economy, and even this worried the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, who called it irrational exuberance, that artificially they were creating wealth. And then, of course, when other people realized that was irrational, then the market crashed. And so this is a financial example of boom and bust. That is, we have phenomena that are not quite in balance, supply and demand, cost and price, and in the global economy, they can cause cycles of recession and expansion. But this is also familiar to us from the animal world. Yes, next slide. On the top, we have a Canadian lynx following a snowshoe hare. So it's a very interesting situation. It's like the global economy. The hares eat grass, and the lynx eat hares. And when the hare population increases, the lynx population increases, but eventually there are too many lynx, and then they eat the hares whose population plummets, and then the lynx population plummets, etc. So in the bottom of this slide, you can see the black curve are the hares, and the bottom curve is the lynx, or similar thing with foxes. So the foxes that are eating the hares go through a similar boom and bust cycle, like irrational exuberance and recession in the economic cycle. And what am I really saying is the prey and what's the predator here? So the prey, in my model of Saturn's rings, are the objects that are growing, those moonlets. And those moonlets create higher velocities in the ring. So the velocity in the ring is like a predator. It lives off of the influence of the biggest moonlets. And so the particles at these locations in Saturn's rings where they're being forced are like the hares eating a lot of grass. And that increases their number, but it also increases the velocity, which preys on them, so that eventually the velocity is so high that when the moonlets run into each other, they get smashed to bits. And so then we're ready for another situation of getting the population excited again, having a boom in the prey population, in the size of the particles, which causes a boom in the predator population, the velocity, relative velocity of particles, which then eats up, smashes up the little particles. And so what I'm trying to draw your attention to in this diagram is that this behavior of aggregation and disaggregation that we see at the perturbed regions in the rings, in the edge of the B ring and in the F ring, might be a boom and bust cycle of accretion. And if that boom and bust cycle oscillates, that's a way to also make larger particles in the rings, even occasionally, which could recycle material in the rings and therefore make them older. Next slide. So here's a comparison of the predator-prey population, where the prey increase, and then the predators, and then the prey plummets, followed by the predators plummeting, and so on. And so, if we go to the last slide, we can discuss this speculation. Why doesn't everybody agree with this? And it's titled "Listener Beware." So once again, I'm saying that moons are forcing the growth of particles in the rings. That explains those strange, unexpected shadows we saw at equinox. Also, the occultation of results from UVIS, and that's a natural way, like boom and bust cycles, to explain an unstable equilibrium in the rings and potentially to make bigger particles that recycle ring material. But beware, first bullet. My explanation is speculative and not in agreement with some other proposals. So Burl et al., that's the English group that looks at the F-ring movies, are more interested in the fluid instability criteria. So instead of watching the cars smash into each other, they're thinking about the waves on an ocean. Spitali and Porco emphasize normal modes, that is, resonances, rather than individual particles. Once again, a fluid approach. And Nicholson et al., I haven't mentioned them, from the VIMS team, have also looked at the B-ring edge, and they also prefer a multi-mode model. And I have to admit, it's a lot easier to solve these things with fluid descriptions, where you have natural modes like channel waves, and where you measure the overall density and velocity instead of the head-on collision of one ring particle with another. But last bullet for today, I prefer a random model that is more random than deterministic, involving multiple modes and particles instead of fluid. So I, instead of a deterministic model of waves and modes, I prefer a stochastic model. And instead of a fluid model, I prefer a kinetic model with lots of individual particles. That's the end of my presentation, and I look forward to any questions you have. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry, very much. Do we have questions for our speaker?
I have one.
Okay.
Where does Enceladus and its emissions come into this picture?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the whole question. Say again.
Where does Enceladus and its emissions come into your picture?
So Enceladus doesn't fit in this picture. You'll have to listen to another talk on that.
Okay. Maybe if you have questions, why don't you identify yourself? It's always interesting to hear who's asking the question as well.
Could I ask another one? I'll identify myself.
Sure.
Sure.
This is Tish from Copernic Observatory in Vestal, New York. My second question is, why would you like to explore Venus next?
Well, it's sort of been the forgotten planet. There are three planets like the Earth in our solar system, Earth, Mars, and Venus. And the concentration for the last decade or so has been on Mars, and we really need to look at the surface of Venus to compare it not only to Mars but to the Earth. And now I just mentioned planets in our solar system. There are going to be planets we find like the Earth in other solar systems. Some of them will look like Venus. So my interest is to look at Venus as a terrestrial planet, to compare it to the Earth and to compare it to planets like the Earth around other stars. But that's also not related to this talk.
A question, Larry?
Yes.
I'm not quite clear on moonlets creating higher velocity in the rings and why they do.
Right. So there are two accelerations on a particle. One is the acceleration of Saturn, which would have the particle in an elliptical orbit. Then there's the acceleration that's created by passing by a nearby large particle.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And that adds an additional velocity which is comparable to the escape velocity of that particle. So the bigger particles have bigger escape velocities and therefore excite higher velocities in the whole system of ring particles.
Sounds like it's all affected by the gravity.
Gravity is the number one thing here.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you might also think that stickiness would help too, and I haven't mentioned stickiness. So that if the particle actually stick to each other, that could be a wiggle on this that I haven't touched on here.
So the larger they get, the greater the velocity.
The larger the particle gets, the greater the velocity of the other particles.
Mm-hmm.
But because that particle interacts with all those little particles, the larger a particle is, the smaller its own velocity.
Yeah. And does it drag the smaller ones along?
Not so much. Unless they actually touch.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Larry.
Yes, you're welcome.
Any other questions for Larry?
Yes, I have one.
Okay.
This
and
is
please
Lynn
identify
from the Netherlands
yourself.
Again. Yeah, Lynn van Rooyen from the Netherlands.
Great.
I was curious if you'd done any computer simulations on a longer term, say 50,000 or 100,000 years, to see if this sort of emotions would occur.
So people have not included this physics in their model. They haven't included the perturbation by a moon on the individual ring particles, except for that simulation I showed you by Lewis and Stewart. And they haven't gone mm-hmm. for 50,000 years. So they like to go for 5 or 10 years, and that utilizes a very large amount of computer time already. The computer models are running about as fast as the system. So in a few months, you can run a few years of simulation. So it would take us, with current computers, about 1 to 10,000 years to run a 50,000-year simulation, including all the physics that I've talked about. That's why I'm looking at simpler models like lynx and hares.
Okay. Well, I was just, maybe this is really off base, but I did a project last semester at Swinburne, and I was doing exoplanets, but I know there's somebody there doing dust particles accumulating to, in this case, to eventually form protoplanets, so I thought on a different scale it might be similar.
Right, but they don't have all the physics we have in here.
They don't have all.
Right, in fact, this is something I would recommend. I know some of those simulations that they include other planets that are like the moons in our model.
Yeah, you can put in the density and the characteristics.
No, but they typically don't put in the other planets that go around on individual orbits. So you can get back to me if I'm wrong about this. But if they are, that is good. But for the most part, in other solar systems, they don't include the effect of one planet on other planets forming.
Okay.
And that's what's the crucial thing here, is the moon perturbs the behavior of the particle in the disk.
No, I understand that. Okay. I'll check and get back to you.
Thank you.
Any additional questions for Larry?
Hi, this is Larry Sessions in Denver. I have a question off Saturn, but some years ago I was fortunate enough to be invited by CU down to your defense of your mission to Pluto at Lockheed Martin.
Yes.
And at that time, as I recall, you were pretty much Pluto is not a planet kind of proponent. And I haven't heard anything from you lately, and that's kind of coming up in the news again. What are your feelings?
So that was a very exciting day in 2003.
Yes.
But I still don't believe Pluto is a planet. It doesn't make the cut. But I think the International Astronomical Union was a little bit ham-handed. They're a little bit abrupt in ignoring the public interest in that, in reaching their conclusion and definition of a planet. And furthermore, their definition is such that it's very hard to explain,
to
mention to apply. So I still would say, as I said then, that that Pluto doesn't fit the class we scientists have for planets. But I think the IAU could use some further refinement on their position of why Pluto isn't a planet.
I agree with you entirely. And at the time, I was at the time, as I recall, Clyde Tombaugh was still alive, and I was, hoping that they wouldn't demote it until he passed. But they didn't, fortunately. But it's obviously not a planet like the others. I agree with you entirely.
Right, so we'll wait for improvements in that situation. Meantime, there are a couple of good books out on this. Neil deGrasse Tyson's book is a very nice one.
Right, good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any additional questions? I was curious, Larry, can you think of observations that we haven't yet made on Cassini that might, throw additional light on this problem and distinguish between the different competing theories?
Yes, exactly. So here's a simple one. If everything is deterministic and explained by Newton's laws, then the phenomena we see will repeat themselves over the rest of the mission. If things are stochastic and random, it's unpredictable, and the data that we're taking on the edge of Saturn's rings with occultations, both by UVIS and VIMS, and of the F ring, both pictures and occultations, will answer this question eventually of whether the rings are random or deterministic, or how much, what balance is there between purely random events and those deterministic events. And furthermore, I think the individual teams, three or more teams comparing their data over the next few years, will possibly clarify this. So I'm having an argument, as I said, a disagreement with two of the other teams, and I'm imagining that we'll find out who was right or wrong in the next few years of the mission. So even if we didn't get new data, we could sort through intercomparing our data better and maybe reach more of a consensus. But even if we don't reach a consensus, the data can be convincing over the years because they will show whether the phenomena are repeatable or are more random.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just keep doing what we're doing. I guess that's you know, this kind of disagreement is how science is done, and ultimately one of the theories will probably prevail.
Right. I'm very excited, even if it turns out that I'm wrong. And in
yeah,
fact,
sure.
Most of the time, I'm wrong about something, sometimes about everything. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Okay, any final questions before we say goodbye to our speaker? I think this was a great talk, Larry. I really appreciate it. You really had some great analogies. I loved your freeway analogy. I was thinking I'd carry it a step further. You know, there are these semis now on the LA freeways, especially the ones that go by JPL, and they kind of reminded me of the little moons because traffic seems to clump around them. So I thought that was kind of
interesting. Oh, exactly. I may use that next time.
Yeah.
Thank you much.
Very good.
Let's see. Well, it was a great talk, and I really appreciate it, Larry. I might mention that Carl Murray is going to give our Charm Telecon in May, and so he will likely touch on some of the competing ideas that Larry described. So,
interesting, and he'll tell me, you know, he's better at a lot of this than I, so he'll also be able to tell me where I'm wrong.
Oh, I'm sure not, but, you know, he'll have some nice pictures to show as well, so... for people out there, be sure and tune into the May telecon. And then Mark Showalter gave a really nice telecon. If you missed it, go back and download that a few months ago on the Equinox, and he gave a really good overview. So I think I'll call the Charm Telecon to a close, and thanks again, Larry, and thanks, everyone, for attending.
Thank
you.
Bye.
Awesome. Bye.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was very interesting.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye. Bye.